mistress. I had slept with him in his bed, in his arms. There is nothing anyone might now say to you about me which I will not tell you first. It will be useless to defame me. I know the nature of the accusations, and I will state them to you myself. Did I feel a physical desire for him? I did. Was I moved by a passion of my body? I was. Have I experienced the most violent form of sensual pleasure? I have. If this now makes me a disgraced woman in your eyes, let your estimate be your own concern. I will stand on mine. Bertram Scudder was staring at her. This was not the speech he had expected, and he felt, in dim panic, that it was not proper to let it continue. But she was the special guest whom the Washington rulers had ordered him to treat cautiously. He could not be certain whether he was now supposed to interrupt her or not. Besides, he enjoyed hearing this sort of story. In the audience booth, James Taggart and Lillian Reardon sat frozen, like animals paralyzed by the headlight of a train rushing down upon them. They were the only ones present who knew the connection between the words they were hearing and the theme of the broadcast. It was too late for them to move. They dared not assume the responsibility of a movement or of whatever was to follow. In the control room, a young intellectual of Chick Morrison's staff stood ready to cut the broadcast off the air in case of trouble, but he saw no political significance in the speech he was hearing, no element he could construe as dangerous to his masters. He was accustomed to hearing speeches extorted by unknown pressure from unwilling victims, and he concluded that this was the case of a reactionary forced to confess a scandal, and that therefore the speech had, perhaps, some political value. Besides, he was curious to hear it. I am proud that he had chosen me to give him pleasure, and that it was he who had been my choice. It was not, as it is for most of you, an act of casual indulgence and mutual contempt. It was the ultimate form of our admiration for each other, with full knowledge of the values by which we made our choice. We are those who do not disconnect the values of their minds from the actions of their bodies, those who do not leave their values to empty dreams, but bring them into existence, those who give material form to thoughts and reality to values, those who make steel, railroads, and happiness. And to such among you who hate the thought of human joy, who wish to see men's life as chronic suffering and failure, who wish men to apologize for happiness, or for success, or ability, or achievement, or wealth, to such among you I am now saying, I wanted him, I had him, I was happy. I had known joy, a pure, full, guiltless joy, the joy you dread to hear confessed by any human being, the joy of which your only knowledge is in your hatred for those who are worthy of reaching it. Well, hate me, then, because I reached it.
Miss Taggart, said Bertram Scudder nervously, aren't we departing from the subject of— After all, your personal relationship with Mr. Reardon has no political significance, which I didn't think it had either. And of course I came here to tell you about the political and moral system under which you are now living. Well, I thought that I knew everything about Hank Reardon, but there was one thing which I did not learn until today. It was the blackmail threat that our relationship would be made public that forced Hank Reardon to sign the gift certificate surrendering Reardon Medal. It was blackmail. Blackmail by your government officials, by your rulers, by your— In the instant when Scudder's hand swept out to knock the microphone over, a faint click came from its throat as it crashed to the floor, signifying that the intellectual cup had cut the broadcast off the air. She laughed. But there was no one to see her and to hear the nature of her laughter. The figures rushing into the glass enclosure were screaming at one another. Chick Morrison was yelling unprintable curses at Bertram Scudder. Bertram Scudder was shouting that he had been opposed to the whole idea, but had been ordered to do it. James Taggart looked like an animal baring its teeth while he snarled at two of Morrison's youngest assistants and avoided the snarls of an older third. The muscles of Lillian Reardon's face had an odd slackness, like the limbs of an animal lying in the road, intact but dead. The morale conditioners were shrieking what they guessed they thought Mr. Mouch would think. "What am I to say to them?" the program announcer was crying, pointing at the microphone. "Mr. Morrison, there's an audience waiting. What am I to say?" Nobody answered him. They were not fighting over what to do, but over whom to blame. Nobody said a word to Dagny or glanced in her direction. Nobody stopped her when she walked out. She stepped into the first taxicab in sight, giving the address of her apartment. As the cab started, she noticed that the dial of the radio on the driver's panel was lighted and silent, crackling with the brief, tense coughs of static. It was tuned to Bertram Scudder's program. She lay back against the seat, feeling nothing but the desolation of the knowledge that the sweep of her action had perhaps swept away the man who might never wish to see her again. She felt for the first time the immensity of the hopelessness of finding him. If he did not choose to be found, in the streets of the city, in the towns of a continent, in the canyons of the Rocky Mountains where the goal was closed by a screen of rays. But one thing remained to her, like a log floating on a void, the log to which she had clung through the broadcast, and she knew that this was the thing she could not abandon, even were she to lose all the rest. It was the sound of his voice saying to her, "Nobody stays here by faking reality in any manner whatever." "Ladies and gentlemen," the voice of Bertram Scudder's announcer crackled suddenly out of the static, "due to technical difficulties over which we have no control, this station will remain off the air, pending the necessary readjustments." The taxi driver gave a brief, contemptuous chuckle and snapped the radio off. When she stepped out and handed him a bill, he extended the change to her and suddenly leaned forward for a closer look at her face. She felt certain that he recognized her, and she held his glance austerely for an instant. His bitter face and his overpatched shirt were worn out by a hopeless losing struggle. As she handed him a tip, he said quietly, with too earnest, too solemn an emphasis for a mere acknowledgment of the coins, "Thank you, ma'am." She turned swiftly and hurried into the building, not to let him see the emotion which was suddenly more than she could bear. Her head was drooping as she unlocked the door of her apartment, and the light struck her from below, from the carpet, before she jerked her head up in astonishment at finding the apartment lighted. She took a step forward and saw Hank Reardon standing across the room. She was held still by two shocks. One was the sight of his presence. She had not expected him to be back so soon. The other was the sight of his face. His face had so firm, so confident, so mature a look of calm in the faint half-smile, in the clarity of the eyes, that she felt as if he had aged decades within 1 month, but aged in the proper sense of human growth, aged in vision, in stature, in power. She felt that he who had lived through a month of agony, he whom she had hurt so deeply and was about to hurt more deeply still, he would now be the one to give her support and consolation. His would be the strength to protect them both. She stood motionless for only an instant, but she saw his smile deepening as if he were reading her thoughts and telling her that she had nothing to fear. She heard a slight crackling sound and saw, on a table beside him, the lighted dial of a silent radio. Her eyes moved to his as a question, and he answered by the faintest nod, barely more than a lowering of his eyelids. He had heard her broadcast. They moved toward each other in the same moment. He seized her shoulders to support her. Her face was raised to his, but he did not touch her lips. He took her hand and kissed her wrist, her fingers, her palm, as the sole form of the greeting which so much of his suffering had gone to await. And suddenly, broken by the whole of this day and of that month, she was sobbing in his arms, slumped against him, sobbing as she had never done in her life, as a woman, in surrender to pain and in a last futile protest against it. Holding her so that she stood and moved only by means of his body, not hers, he led her to the couch and tried to make her sit down beside him, but she slipped to the floor, to sit at his feet and bury her face in his knees, and sob without defense or disguise. He did not lift her. He let her cry, with his arm tight about her. She felt his hand on her head, on her shoulder. She felt the protection of his firmness, a firmness which seemed to tell her that as her tears were for both of them, so was his knowledge, that he knew her pain and felt it and understood, yet was able to witness it calmly. And his calm seemed to lift her burden by granting her the right to break here at his feet, by telling her that he was able to carry what she could not carry any longer. She knew dimly that this was the real Hank Reardon, and no matter what form of insulting cruelty he had once given to their first nights together, no matter how often she had seemed as the stronger of the two, this had always been within him and at the root of their bond. This strength of his which would protect her if ever hers were gone. When she raised her head, he was smiling down at her. "Hank," she whispered guiltily, in desperate astonishment at her own break. "Quiet, darling." She let her face drop back on his knees. She lay still, fighting for rest, fighting against the pressure of a wordless thought. He had been able to bear and to accept her broadcast only as a confession of her love. It made the truth she now had to tell him more inhuman a blow than anyone had the right to deliver. She felt terror at the thought that she would not have the strength to do it, and terror at the thought that she would. When she looked up at him again, he ran his hand over her forehead, brushing the hair off her face. "It's over, darling," he said. "The worst of it is over for both of us." "No, Hank, it isn't." He smiled. He drew her to sit beside him with her head on his shoulder. "Don't say anything now," he said. "You know that we both understand all that has to be said, and we'll speak of it, but not until it has ceased to hurt you quite so much." His hand moved down the line of her sleeve, down a fold of her skirt, with so light a pressure that it seemed as if the hand did not feel the body inside the clothes, as if he were regaining possession not of her body, but only of its vision. "You've taken too much," he said. "So have I. Let them batter us. There's no reason why we should add to it. No matter what we have to face, there can be no suffering between the two of us. No added pain. Let that come from their world. It won't come from us. Don't be afraid. We won't hurt each other. Not now." She raised her head, shaking it with a bitter smile. There was a desperate violence in her movement, but the smile was a sign of recovery, of the determination to face the despair. "Hank, the kind of hell I let you go through in the last month?" Her voice was trembling. "It's nothing compared to the kind of hell I let you go through in the last hour." His voice was steady. She got up to pace the room, to prove her strength, her steps like words telling him that she was not to be spared any longer. When she stopped and turned to face him, he rose, as if he understood her motive. "I know that I've made it worse for you," she said, pointing at the radio. He shook his head. "No." "Hank, there's something I have to tell you." "So have I. Will you let me speak first? You see, it's something I should have said to you long ago. Will you let me speak and not answer me until I finish?" She nodded. He took a moment to look at her as she stood before him, as if to hold the full sight of her figure, of this moment, and of everything that had led them to it. "I love you, Dagny," he said quietly, with the simplicity of an unclouded yet unsmiling happiness. She was about to speak, but knew that she couldn't, even if he had permitted it. She caught her unuttered words. The movement of her lips was her only answer. Then she inclined her head in acceptance.
I love you, has the same value, has the same expression, with the same pride and the same meaning as I love my work, my mills, my metal, my hours at a desk, at a furnace, in a laboratory, in an ore mine, as I love my ability to work, as I love the act of sight and knowledge, as I love the action of my mind when it solves a chemical equation or grasps a sunrise, as I love the things I've made and the things I've felt as my product, as my choice, as a shape of my world, as my best mirror, as the wife I've never had, as that which makes all the rest of it possible, as my power to live. She did not drop her face, but kept it level and open, to hear and accept as he wanted her to, and as he deserved. I loved you from the first day I saw you, on a flat car on a siding of Milford Station. I loved you when we rode in the cab of the first engine on the John Galt line. I loved you on the gallery of Ellis Wyatt's house. I loved you on that next morning. You knew it. But it's I who must say it to you, as I'm saying it now, if I am to redeem all those days and to let them be fully what they were for both of us. I loved you. You knew it. I didn't. And because I didn't, I had to learn it when I sat at my desk and looked at the gift certificate for Reardon Medal. She closed her eyes, but there was no suffering in his face, nothing but the immense and quiet happiness of clarity. We are those who do not disconnect the values of their minds from the actions of their bodies. You said it in your broadcast tonight. But you knew it then on that morning in Ellis Wyatt's house. You knew that all those insults I was throwing at you were the fullest confession of love a man could make. You knew that the physical desire I was damning as our mutual shame is neither physical nor an expression of one's body, but the expression of one's mind's deepest values, whether one has the courage to know it or not. That was why you laughed at me as you did, wasn't it? Yes, she whispered. You said, I do not want your mind, your will, your being, or your soul, so long as it's to me that you will come for that lowest one of your desires. You knew when you said it that it was my mind, my will, my being, and my soul that I was giving you by means of that desire. And I want to say it now, to let that morning mean what it meant. My mind, my will, my being, and my soul, Dagny. Yours, for as long as I shall live. He was looking straight at her, and she saw a brief sparkle in his eyes, which was not a smile, but almost as if he had heard the cry she had not uttered. Let me finish, dearest. I want you to know how fully I know what I am saying. I, who thought that I was fighting them, I had accepted the worst of our enemy's creed. And that is what I've paid for ever since, as I am paying now and as I must. I had accepted the one tenet by which they destroy a man before he's started, the killer tenet, the breach between his mind and body. I had accepted it, like most of their victims, not knowing it, not knowing even that the issue existed. I rebelled against their creed of human impotence, and I took pride in my ability to think, to act, to work for the satisfaction of my desires. But I did not know that this was virtue. I never identified it as a moral value, as the highest of moral values, to be defended above one's life, because it's that which makes life possible. And I accepted punishment for it. Punishment for virtue at the hands of an arrogant evil, made arrogant solely by my ignorance and my submission. I accepted their insults, their frauds, their extortions.
I thought I could afford to ignore them. All those impotent mystics who prattle about their souls and are unable to build a roof over their heads. I thought that the world was mine, and that those jabbering incompetents were no threat to my strength. I could not understand why I kept losing every battle. I did not know that the force unleashed against me was my own. While I was busy conquering matter, I had surrendered to them the realm of the mind, of thought, of principle, of law, of values, of morality. I had accepted, unwittingly and by default, the tenet that ideas were of no consequence to one's existence, to one's work, to reality, to this earth, as if ideas were not the province of reason, but of that mystic faith which I despised. This was all they wanted me to concede. It was enough. I had surrendered that which all of their claptrap is designed to subvert and to destroy. Man's reason. No, they were not able to deal with matter, to produce abundance, to control this earth. They did not have to. They controlled me. I, who knew that wealth is only a means to an end, created the means and let them prescribe my ends. I, who took pride in my ability to achieve the satisfaction of my desires, let them prescribe the code of values by which I judged my desires. I, who shaped matter to serve my purpose, was left with a pile of steel and gold, but with my every purpose defeated, my every desire betrayed, my every attempt at happiness frustrated. I had cut myself in two, as the mystics preached, and I ran my business by one code of rules, but my own life by another. I rebelled against the looters' attempt to set the price and value of my steel, but I let them set the moral values of my life. I rebelled against demands for an unearned wealth, but I thought it was my duty to grant an unearned love to a wife I despised, an unearned respect to a mother who hated me, an unearned support to a brother who plotted for my destruction. I rebelled against undeserved financial injury, but I accepted a life of undeserved pain. I rebelled against the doctrine that my productive ability was guilt, but I accepted as guilt my capacity for happiness. I rebelled against the creed that virtue is some disembodied unknowable of the spirit. But I damned you, you, my dearest one, for the desire of your body and mine. But if the body is evil, then so are those who provide the means of its survival. So is material wealth and those who produce it. And if moral values are set in contradiction to our physical existence, then it's right that rewards should be unearned, that virtue should consist of the undone, that there should be no tie between achievement and profit, that the inferior animals who are able to produce should serve those superior beings whose superiority in spirit consists of incompetence in the flesh. If some man like Hugh Axton had told me when I started that by accepting the mystic's theory of sex I was accepting the looter's theory of economics, I would have laughed in his face. I would not laugh at him now. Now I see Reardon Steele being ruled by human scum. I see the achievement of my life serving to enrich the worst of my enemies. And as to the only two persons I ever loved, I've brought a deadly insult to one and public disgrace to the other. I slapped the face of the man who was my friend, my defender, my teacher, the man who set me free by helping me to learn what I've learned. I loved him, Dagny. He was the brother, the son, the comrade I never had. But I knocked him out of my life because he would not help me to produce for the looters. I'd give anything now to have him back, but I own nothing to offer in such repayment, and I'll never see him again, because it's I who'll know that there is no way to deserve even the right to ask forgiveness. But what I've done to you, my dearest, is still worse. your speech, and that you had to make it. That's what I've brought upon the only woman I loved, in payment for the only happiness I've known. Don't tell me that it was your choice from the first, and that you accepted all consequences, including tonight. It does not redeem the fact that it was I who had no better choice to offer you, and that the looters forced you to speak, that you spoke to avenge me and set me free. Does not redeem the fact that it was I who made their tactics possible. It was not their own convictions of sin and dishonor that they could use to disgrace you, it was mine. They merely carried out the things I believed and said in Ellis Wyatt's house. It was I who kept our love hidden as a guilty secret. They merely treated it for what it was by my own appraisal. It was I who was willing to counterfeit reality for the sake of appearance in their eyes. They merely cashed in on the right I had given them. People think that a liar gains a victory over his victim. What I've learned is that a lie is an act of self-abdication, because one surrenders one's reality to the person to whom one lies, making that person one's master, condemning oneself from then on to faking the sort of reality that person's view requires to be faked. And if one gains the immediate purpose of the lie, the price one pays is the destruction of that which the gain was intended to serve. The man who lies to the world is the world's slave from then on. When I chose to hide my love for you, to disavow it in public and live it as a lie, I made it public property, and the public has claimed it in a fitting sort of manner. I had no way to avert it and no power to save you. When I gave in to the looters, when I signed their gift certificate to protect you, I was still faking reality. There was nothing else left open to me. And Agnes, I'd rather have seen us both dead than permit them to do what they threatened. But there are no white lies. There is only the blackness of destruction, and a white lie is the blackest of all. I was still faking reality, and it had the inexorable result. Instead of protection, it brought you a more terrible kind of ordeal. Instead of saving your name, it forced you to offer yourself for a public stoning and to throw the stones by your own hand. I know that you were proud of the things you said, and I was proud to hear you. But that was the pride we should have claimed 2 years ago. No, you did not make it worse for me. You set me free. You saved us both. You redeemed our past. I can't ask you to forgive me. We're far beyond such terms, and the only atonement I can offer you is the fact that I am happy. That I am happy, my darling, not that I suffer. I am happy that I have seen the truth, even if my power of sight is all that's left to me now. Were I to surrender to pain and give up in futile regret that my own error has wrecked my past, that would be the act of final treason, the ultimate failure toward that truth I regret having failed. But if my love of truth is left as my only possession, then the greater the loss behind me, the greater the pride I may take in the price I have paid for that love. Then the wreckage will not become a funeral mount above me, but will serve as a height I have climbed to attain a wider field of vision. My pride and my power of vision were all that I owned when I started, and whatever I achieved was achieved by means of them. Both are greater now. Now I have the knowledge of the superlative value I had missed, of my right to be proud of my vision. The rest is mine to reach. And Agnes, the one thing I wanted as the first step of my future was to say that I love you, as I'm saying it now. I love you, my dearest, with that blindest passion of my body which comes from the clearest perception of my mind, and my love for you is the only attainment of my past that will be left to me unchanged through all the years ahead. I wanted to say it to you while I still had the right to say it, and because I had not said it at our beginning, this is the way I have to say it. At the end. Now I'll tell you what it was that you wanted to tell me, because you see I know it and I accept. Somewhere within the past month, you have met the man you love. And if love means one's final irreplaceable choice, then he is the only man you've ever loved.
Yes.
Her voice was half gasp, half scream, as under a physical blow, with shock as her only awareness.
Hank, how did you know it?
He smiled and pointed at the radio. My darling, you used nothing but the past tense.
Oh.
Her voice was now half gasp, half moan, and she closed her eyes. You never pronounced the one word you would have rightfully thrown at them were it otherwise. You said, I wanted him, not I love him. You told me on the phone today that you could have returned sooner. No other reason would have made you leave me as you did. Only that one reason was valid and right. She was leaning back a little, as if fighting for balance to stand, yet she was looking straight at him, with a smile that did not part her lips, but softened her eyes to a glance of admiration and her mouth to a shape of pain.
It's true. I've met the man I love and will always love. I've seen him, I've spoken to him. But he's a man whom I can't have, whom I may never have, and perhaps may never see again.
I think I've always known that you would find him. I knew what you felt for me. I knew how much it was, but I knew that I was not your final choice. What you'll give him is not taken away from me. It's what I've never had. I can't rebel against it. What I've had means too much to me, and that I've had it can never be changed.
Do you want me to say it, Hank? Will you understand it if I say that I'll always love you?
I think I've understood it before you did.
I've always seen you as you are now. That greatness of yours which you are just beginning to allow yourself to know, I've always known it, and I've watched your struggle to discover it. Don't speak of atonement. You have not hurt me. Your mistakes came from your magnificent integrity under the torture of an impossible code. And your fight against it did not bring me suffering. It brought me the feeling I've found too seldom. Admiration. If you will accept it, it will always be yours. What you meant to me can never be changed. But the man I met, he is the love I had wanted to reach long before I knew that he existed, and I think he will remain beyond my reach, but that I love him will be enough to keep me living.
He took her hand and pressed it to his lips. Then you know what I feel, he said, and why I am still happy. Looking up at his face, she realized that for the first time he was what she had always thought him intended to be. A man with an immense capacity for the enjoyment of existence. The taut look of endurance, of fiercely unadmitted pain, was gone. Now, in the midst of the wreckage and of his hardest hour, his face had the serenity of pure strength. It had the look she had seen in the faces of the men in the valley.
Hank, she whispered, I don't think I can explain it. But I feel that I have committed no treason, either to you or to him.
You haven't. Her eyes seemed abnormally alive in a face drained of color, as if her consciousness remained untouched in a body broken by exhaustion. He made her sit down and slipped his arm along the back of the couch, not touching her, yet holding her in a protective embrace. Now tell me, he asked, where were you?
I can't tell you that.
I've given my word never to reveal anything about it. I can say only that it's a place I found by accident when I crashed, and I left it blindfolded, and I wouldn't be able to find it again. Couldn't you trace your way back to it?
I won't try.
And the man?
I won't look for him.
He remained there?
I don't know.
Why did you leave him?
I can't tell you.
Who is he? Her chuckle of desperate amusement was involuntary.
Who is John Galt?
He glanced at her, astonished, but realized that she was not joking. So there is a John Galt, he asked slowly.
Yes.
That slang phrase refers to him?
Yes.
And it has some special meaning?
Oh, yes. There's one thing I can tell you about him, because I discovered it earlier, without promise of secrecy. He is the man who invented the motor we found.
Oh. He smiled, as if he should have known it. Then he said softly, with a glance that was almost compassion, He's the destroyer, isn't he? He saw her look of shock and added, No, don't answer me if you can't. I think I know where you were. It was Quentin Daniels that you wanted to save from the destroyer. And you were following Daniels when you crashed, weren't you?
Yes.
Good God, Dagny. Does such a place really exist? Are they all alive? Is there... I'm sorry. Don't answer.
She smiled. It does exist.
He remained silent for a long time.
Hank, could you give up Reardon Steele?
No. The answer was fiercely immediate, but he added, with the first sound of hopelessness in his voice, Not yet. Then he looked at her, as if, in the transition of his three words, he had lived the course of her agony of the past month.
I see, he said.
He ran his hand over her forehead with a gesture of understanding, of compassion, of an almost incredulous wonder. What hell you've now undertaken to endure, he said, his voice low. She nodded. She slipped down to lie stretched, her face on his knees. He stroked her hair. He said, We'll fight the looters as long as we can. I don't know what future is possible to us, but we'll win, or we'll learn that it's hopeless. Until we do, we'll fight for our world. We're all that's left of it. She fell asleep, lying there, her hand clasping his. Her last awareness, before she surrendered the responsibility of consciousness, was the sense of an enormous void. The void of a city and of a continent where she would never be able to find the man whom she had no right to seek.
Chapter 4. Anti-Life.
James Taggart reached into the pocket of his dinner jacket, pulled out the first wad of paper he found, which was a $100 bill, and dropped it into the beggar's hand. He noticed that the beggar pocketed the money in a manner as indifferent as his own.
Thanks, bud, said the beggar contemptuously, and walked away.
James Taggart remained still in the middle of the sidewalk, wondering what gave him a sense of shock and dread. It was not the man's insolence. He had not sought any gratitude. He had not been moved by pity. His gesture had been automatic and meaningless. It was that the beggar acted as if he would have been indifferent had he received $100 or a dime, or, failing to find any help whatever, had seen himself dying of starvation within this night. Taggart shuddered and walked brusquely on, the shudder serving to cut off the realization that the beggar's mood matched his own. The walls of the street around him had the stressed, unnatural clarity of a summer twilight, while an orange haze filled the channels of intersections and veiled the tiers of roofs, leaving him on a shrinking remnant of ground. The calendar in the sky seemed to stand insistently out of the haze, yellow like a page of old parchment, saying, August 5th. No, he thought, in answer to things he had not named. It was not true. He felt fine. That's why he wanted to do something tonight. He could not admit to himself that his peculiar restlessness came from a desire to experience pleasure. He could not admit that the particular pleasure he wanted was that of celebration, because he could not admit what it was that he wanted to celebrate. This had been a day of intense activity, spent on words floating as vaguely as cotton, yet achieving a purpose as precisely as an adding machine, summing up to his full satisfaction. But his purpose and the nature of his satisfaction had to be kept as carefully hidden from himself as they had been from others, and his sudden craving for pleasure was a dangerous breach. The day had started with a small luncheon in the hotel suite of a visiting Argentinian legislator, where a few people of various nationalities had talked at leisurely length about the climate of Argentina, its soil, its resources, the needs of its people, the value of a dynamic, progressive attitude toward the future, and had mentioned, as the briefest topic of conversation, that Argentina would be declared a people's state within 2 weeks. It had been followed by a few cocktails at the home of Orrin Boyle, with only one unobtrusive gentleman from Argentina sitting silently in a corner, while two executives from Washington and a few friends of unspecified positions had talked about national resources, metallurgy, mineralogy, neighborly disputes, and the welfare of the globe, and had mentioned that a loan of $4 billion would be granted within 3 weeks to the People's State of Argentina and the People's State of Chile. It had been followed by a small cocktail party in a private room of the bar built like a cellar on the roof of a skyscraper, an informal party given by him, James Taggart, for the directors of a recently formed company, the Interneighborly Amity and Development Corporation, of which Orrin Boyle was president, and a slender, graceful, overactive man from Chile was treasurer, a man whose name was Señor Mario Martinez, but whom Taggart was tempted, by some resemblance of spirit, to call Señor Cuffy Meggs. Here they had talked about golf, horse races, boat races, automobiles, and women. It had not been necessary to mention, since they all knew it, that the Interneighborly Amity and Development Corporation had an exclusive contract to operate on a 20-year managerial lease all the industrial properties of the People's States of the Southern Hemisphere. The last event of the day had been a large dinner reception at the home of Señor Rodrigo González, a diplomatic representative of Chile. No one had heard of Señor González a year ago, but he had become famous for the parties he had given in the past 6 months, ever since his arrival in New York. His guests described him as a progressive businessman. He had lost his property, it was said, when Chile, becoming a people's state, had nationalized all properties, except those belonging to citizens of backward, non-people's countries, such as Argentina. But he had adopted an enlightened attitude and had joined the new regime, placing himself in the service of his country. His home in New York occupied an entire floor of an exclusive residential hotel. He had a fat, blank face and the eyes of a killer. Watching him at tonight's reception, Taggart had concluded that the man was impervious to any sort of feeling. He looked as if a knife could slash unnoticed through his pendulous layers of flesh, except that there was a lewd, almost sexual relish in the way he rubbed his feet against the rich pile of his Persian rugs, or patted the polished arm of his chair, or folded his lips about a cigar. His wife, the Señora González, was a small, attractive woman, not as beautiful as she assumed, but enjoying the reputation of a beauty by means of a violent, nervous energy and an odd manner of loose, warm, cynical self-assertiveness that seemed to promise anything and to absolve anyone. It was known that her particular brand of trading was her husband's chief asset, in an age when one traded not goods, but favors. And watching her among the guests, Taggart had found amusement in wondering what deals had been made, what directives issued, what industries destroyed in exchange for a few chance nights, which most of those men had had no reason to seek and perhaps could no longer remember. The party had bored him. There had been only half a dozen persons for whose sake he had put in an appearance, and it had not been necessary to speak to that half-dozen, merely to be seen and to exchange a few glances. Dinner had been about to be served when he had heard what he had come to hear. Señor González had mentioned, the smoke of his cigar weaving over the half-dozen men who had drifted toward his armchair, that by agreement with the future People's State of Argentina,
the properties of Danconia copper would be nationalized by the People's State of Chile in less than a month, on September 2nd. It had all gone as Taggart had expected. The unexpected had come when, on hearing those words, he had felt an irresistible urge to escape. He had felt incapable of enduring the boredom of the dinner, as if some other form of activity were needed to greet the achievement of this night. He had walked out into the summer twilight of the streets, feeling as if he were both pursuing and pursued, pursuing a pleasure which nothing could give him, in celebration of a feeling which he dared not name, pursued by the dread of discovering what motive had moved him through the planning of tonight's achievement, and what aspect of it now gave him this feverish sense of gratification. He reminded himself that he would sell his Danconia copper stock, which had never rallied fully after its crash of last year, and he would purchase shares of the Interneighborly Amity and Development Corporation, as agreed with his friends, which would bring him a fortune. But the thought brought him nothing but boredom. This was not the thing he wanted to celebrate. He tried to force himself to enjoy it. Money, he thought, had been his motive. Money, nothing worse. Wasn't that a normal motive? A valid one? Wasn't that what they all were after? The Wyatts, the Reardons, the Danconias? He jerked his head to stop it. He felt as if his thoughts were slipping down a dangerous blind alley, the end of which he must never permit himself to see. No, he thought bleakly, in reluctant admission. Money meant nothing to him any longer. He had thrown dollars about by the hundreds, at that party he had given today, for unfinished drinks, for uneaten delicacies, for unprovoked tips and unexpected whims, for a long-distance phone call to Argentina because one of the guests had wanted to check the exact version of a smutty story he had started telling. For the spur of any moment, for the clammy stupor of knowing that it was easier to pay than to think. "You've got nothing to worry about under that railroad unification plan," Orrin Boyle had giggled to him drunkenly. Under the railroad unification plan, a local railroad had gone bankrupt in North Dakota, abandoning the region to the fate of a blighted area. The local banker had committed suicide, first killing his wife and children. A freight train had been taken off the schedule in Tennessee, leaving a local factory without transportation at a day's notice. The factory owner's son had quit college and was now in jail, awaiting execution for a murder committed with a gang of raiders. A way station had been closed in Kansas, and the station agent, who had wanted to be a scientist, had given up his studies and become a dishwasher. That he, James Taggart, might sit in a private bar room and pay for the alcohol pouring down Orrin Boyle's throat, for the waiter who sponged Boyle's garments when he spilled his drink over his chest, for the carpet burned by the cigarettes of an ex-pimp from Chile who did not want to take the trouble of reaching for an ashtray across a distance of 3 feet. It was not the knowledge of his indifference to money that now gave him a shudder of dread. It was the knowledge that he would be equally indifferent were he reduced to the state of the beggar. There had been a time when he had felt some measure of guilt, in no clearer a form than a touch of irritation, at the thought that he shared the sin of greed, which he spent his time denouncing. Now he was hit by the chill realization that, in fact, he had never been a hypocrite. In full truth, he had never cared for money. This left another hole gaping open before him, leading into another blind alley which he could not risk seeing. "I just want to do something tonight," he cried soundlessly to someone at large, in protest and in demanding anger. In protest against whatever it was that kept forcing these thoughts into his mind, in anger at a universe where some malevolent power would not permit him to find enjoyment without the need to know what he wanted or why. "What do you want?" some enemy voice kept asking, and he walked faster, trying to escape it. It seemed to him that his brain was a maze where a blind alley opened at every turn, leading into a fog that hid an abyss. It seemed to him that he was running, while the small island of safety was shrinking, and nothing but those alleys would soon be left. It was like the remnant of clarity in the street around him, with the haze rolling in to fill all exits. "Why did it have to shrink?"
he thought in panic. This was the way he had lived all his life, keeping his eyes stubbornly, safely on the immediate pavement before him, craftily avoiding the sight of his road, of corners, of distances, of pinnacles. He had never intended going anywhere. He had wanted to be free of progression, free of the yoke of a straight line. He had never wanted his years to add up to any sum. What had summed them up? Why had he reached some unchosen destination where one could no longer stand still or retreat?
"Look where you're going, brother," snarled some voice, while an elbow pushed him back, and he realized that he had collided with some large, ill-smelling figure, and that he had been running.
He slowed his steps and admitted into his mind a recognition of the streets he had chosen in his random escape. He had not wanted to know that he was going home to his wife. That, too, was a fog-bound alley, but there was no other left to him. He knew, the moment he saw Cheryl's silent, poised figure as she rose at his entrance into her room, that this was more dangerous than he had allowed himself to know, and that he would not find what he wanted. But danger to him was a signal to shut off his sight, suspend his judgment, and pursue an unaltered course, on the unstated premise that the danger would remain unreal by the sovereign power of his wish not to see it, like a foghorn within him, blowing, not to sound a warning, but to summon the fog. "Why, yes, I did have an important business banquet to attend. But I changed my mind. I felt like having dinner with you tonight," he said in the tone of a compliment. But a quiet, "I see," was the only answer he obtained. He felt irritation at her unastonished manner and her pale, unrevealing face. He felt irritation at the smooth efficiency with which she gave instructions to the servants, then at finding himself in the candlelight of the dining room, facing her across a perfectly appointed table with two crystal cups of fruit and silver bowls of ice between them. It was her poise that irritated him most. She was no longer an incongruous little freak, dwarfed by the luxury of the residence which a famous artist had designed. She matched it. She sat at the table as if she were the kind of hostess that room had the right to demand. She wore a tailored housecoat of russet-colored brocade that blended with the bronze of her hair, the severe simplicity of its lines serving as her only ornament. He would have preferred the jingling bracelets and rhinestone buckles of her past. Her eyes disturbed him, as they had for months. They were neither friendly nor hostile, but watchful and questioning. "I closed a big deal today," he said, his tone part boastful, part pleading. "A deal involving this whole continent and half a dozen governments." He realized that the awe, the admiration, the eager curiosity he had expected belonged to the face of the little shop girl who had ceased to exist. He saw none of it in the face of his wife. Even anger or hatred would have been preferable to her level, attentive glance. The glance was worse than accusing. It was inquiring. "What deal, Jim?"
"What do you mean, what deal? Why are you suspicious? Why do you have to start prying at once?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't know it was confidential. You don't have to answer me."
"It's not confidential." He waited, but she remained silent.
"Well? Aren't you going to say anything?" "Why, no," she said it simply, as if to please him.
"So you're not interested at all?"
"But I thought you didn't want to discuss it."
"Oh, don't be so tricky," he snapped. "It's a big business deal." "That's what you admire, isn't it? Big business?" "Well, it's bigger than anything those boys ever dreamed of. They spend their lives grubbing for their fortunes penny by penny, while I can do it like that." He snapped his fingers. "Just like that. It's the biggest single stunt ever pulled."
"Stunt, Jim?"
"Deal."
"And you did it? Yourself?"
"You bet I did it. That fat fool Orrin Boyle couldn't have swung it in a million years. This took knowledge and skill and timing." He saw a spark of interest in her eyes. "And psychology." The spark vanished, but he went rushing heedlessly on. One had to know how to approach Wesley, and how to keep the wrong influences away from him, and how to get Mr. Thompson interested without letting him know too much, and how to cut Chick Morrison in on it, but keep Tinky Holloway out, and how to get the right people to give a few parties for Wesley at the right time, and... Say, Cheryl, is there any champagne in this house?
Champagne? Can't we do something special tonight? Can't we have a sort of celebration together?
We can have champagne. Yes, Jim, of course. She rang the bell and gave the orders in her odd, lifeless, uncritical manner, a manner of meticulous compliance with his wishes, while volunteering none of her own.
You don't seem to be very impressed, he said.
But what would you know about business anyway? You wouldn't be able to understand anything on so large a scale. Wait till September 2nd. Wait till they hear about it.
They? Who?
He glanced at her, as if he had let a dangerous word slip out involuntarily. We've organized a setup where me, Oren, and a few friends, are going to control every industrial property south of the border.
Whose property?
Why, the people's. This is not an old-fashioned grab for private profit. It's a deal with a mission. A worthy, public-spirited mission to manage the nationalized properties of the various people's states of South America, to teach their workers our modern techniques of production, to help the underprivileged who've never had a chance to... He broke off abruptly, though she had merely sat looking at him without shifting her glance.
You know, he said suddenly, with a cold little chuckle, if you're so damn anxious to hide that you came from the slums, you ought to be less indifferent to the philosophy of social welfare. It's always the poor who lack humanitarian instincts. One has to be born to wealth in order to know the finer feelings of altruism.
I've never tried to hide that I came from the slums, she said in the simple, impersonal tone of a factual correction. And I haven't any sympathy for that welfare philosophy. I've seen enough of them to know what makes the kind of poor who want something for nothing. He did not answer, and she added suddenly, her voice astonished but firm, as if in final confirmation of a long-standing doubt,
Jim, you don't care about it either. You don't care about any of that welfare hogwash.
Well, if money is all that you're interested in, he snapped, let me tell you that that deal will bring me a fortune. That's what you've always admired, isn't it? Wealth?
It depends.
I think I'll end up as one of the richest men in the world, he said. He did not ask what her admiration depended upon. There's nothing I won't be able to afford. Nothing. Just name it. I can give you anything you want. Go on, name it.
I don't want anything, Jim.
But I'd like to give you a present. To celebrate the occasion, see? Anything you take it into your head to ask. Anything.
I can do it. I want to show you that I can do it.
Any fancy you care to name.
I haven't any fancies.
Oh, come on. Want a yacht?
No.
Want me to buy you the whole neighborhood where you lived in Buffalo?
No.
Want the crown jewels of the People's State of England? They can be had, you know. That People's State has been hinting about it on the black market for a long time. But there aren't any old-fashioned tycoons left who are able to afford it. I'm able to afford it. Or will be, after September 2nd. Want it?
No.
Then what do you want?
I don't want anything, Jim.
But you've got to. You've got to want something, damn you! She looked at him, faintly startled, but otherwise indifferent.
Oh, all right. I'm sorry, he said. He seemed astonished by his own outbreak. I just wanted to please you, he added sullenly. But I guess you can't understand it at all. You don't know how important it is. You don't know how big a man you're married to.
I'm trying to find out, she said slowly. Do you still think, as you used to, that Hank Reardon is a great man? Yes, Jim, I do. Well, I've got him beaten. I'm greater than any of them, greater than Reardon, and greater than that other lover of my sister's who... He stopped, as if he had slid too far. Jim, she asked evenly, what is going to happen on September 2nd? He glanced up at her from under his forehead, a cold glance, while his muscles creased into a semi-smile, as if in cynical breach of some hallowed restraint. They're going to nationalize Danconia Copper, he said. He heard the long, harsh roll of a motor as a plane went by somewhere in the darkness above the roof, then a thin tinkle as a piece of ice settled, melting in the silver bowl of his fruit cup, before she answered. She said, he was your friend, wasn't he? Oh, shut up! He remained silent, not looking at her. When his eyes came back to her face, she was still watching him, and she spoke first, her voice oddly stern. What your sister did in her radio broadcast was great. Yes, I know, you've been saying that for a month. You've never answered me. What is there to answer? Just as your friends in Washington have never answered her. He remained silent. Jim, I'm not dropping the subject. He did not answer. Your friends in Washington never uttered a word about it. They did not deny the things, she said. They did not explain. They did not try to justify themselves. They acted as if she had never spoken. I think they're hoping that people will forget it. Some people will. But the rest of us know what she said, and that your friends were afraid to fight her. That's not true. The proper action was taken, and the incident is closed, and I don't see why you keep bringing it up. What action? Bertram Scudder was taken off the air, as a program not in the public interest at the present time. Does that answer her? It closes the issue, and there's nothing more to be said about it. About a government that works by blackmail and extortion? You can't say that nothing was done. It's been publicly announced that Scudder's programs were disruptive, destructive, and untrustworthy. Jim, I want to understand this. Scudder wasn't on her side. He was on yours. He didn't even arrange that broadcast. He was acting on orders from Washington, wasn't he? I thought you didn't like Bertram Scudder. I didn't, and I don't, but then what do you care? But he was innocent, as far as your friends were concerned, wasn't he? I wish you wouldn't bother with politics. You talk like a fool. He was innocent, wasn't he? So what? She looked at him, her eyes incredulously wide. Then they just made him the scapegoat, didn't they? Oh, don't sit there looking like Eddie Willers. Do I? I like Eddie Willers. He's honest. He's a damn halfwit who doesn't have the faintest idea of how to deal with practical reality. But you do, don't you, Jim? You bet I do. Then couldn't you have helped Scudder? I? He burst into helpless, angry laughter. Why don't you grow up? I did my best to get Scudder thrown to the lions. Somebody had to be. Don't you know that it was my neck if some other hadn't been found? Your neck? Why not Dagny's, if she was wrong? Because she wasn't? Dagny is in an entirely different category. It had to be Scudder or me. Why? And it's much better for national policy to let it be Scudder. This way it's not necessary to argue about what she said. And if anybody brings it up, we start howling that it was said on Scudder's program, and that Scudder's programs have been discredited, and that Scudder is a proven fraud and liar, etc., etc. And you think the public will be able to unscramble it? Nobody's ever trusted Bertram Scudder anyway. Don't stare at me like that. Would you rather they'd picked me to discredit? Why not Dagny? Because her speech could not be discredited? If you're so damn sorry for Bertram Scudder, you should have seen him try his damnedest to make them break my neck. He's been doing that for years. How do you think he got to where he was, except by climbing on carcasses? He thought he was pretty powerful, too. You should have seen how the big business tycoons used to be afraid of him. But he got himself outmaneuvered this time. This time, he belonged to the wrong faction. Dimly, through the pleasant stupor of relaxing, of sprawling back in his chair and smiling, he knew that this was the enjoyment he wanted. To be himself. To be himself, he thought, in the drugged, precarious state of floating past the deadliest of his blind alleys, the one that led to the question of what was himself. You see, he belonged to the Tinky Holloway faction. It was pretty much of a seesaw for a while between the Tinky Holloway faction and the Chick Morrison faction, but we won. Tinky made a deal and agreed to scuttle his pal Bertram in exchange for a few things he needed from us. You should have heard Bertram howl, but he was a dead duck and he knew it. He started on a rolling chuckle, but choked it off as the haze cleared and he saw his wife's face. "Jim," she whispered, "is that the sort of victories you're winning?" "Oh, for Christ's sake," he screamed, smashing his fists down on the table. "Where have you been all these years? What sort of world do you think you're living in?" His blow had upset his water glass, and the water went spreading in dark stains over the lace of the tablecloth. "I'm trying to find out," she whispered. Her shoulders were sagging, and her face looked suddenly worn, an odd, aged look that seemed haggard and lost. "I couldn't help it," he burst out in the silence. "I'm not to blame. I have to take things as I find them. It's not I who've made this world." He was shocked to see that she smiled, a smile of so fiercely bitter a contempt that it seemed incredible on her gently patient face. She was not looking at him, but at some image of her own. "That's what my father used to say when he got drunk at the corner saloon instead of looking for work." "How dare you try comparing me to—" he started, but did not finish, because she was not listening. Her words, when she looked at him again, astonished him as completely irrelevant. "The date of that nationalization. September 2nd, she asked, her voice wistful. "Was it you who picked it?" "No. I had nothing to do with it. It's the date of some special session of their legislature. Why?"
"It's the date of our first wedding anniversary."
"Oh? Oh, that's right." He smiled, relieved at the change to a safe subject. "We'll have been married a year. My, it doesn't seem that long."
"It seems much longer," she said tonelessly. She was looking off again, and he felt in sudden uneasiness that the subject was not safe at all.
He wished she would not look as if she were seeing the whole course of that year and of their marriage.
"Not to get scared, but to learn," she thought. "The thing to do is not to get scared, but to learn."
The words came from a sentence she had repeated to herself so often that it felt like a pillar polished smooth by the helpless weight of her body, the pillar that had supported her through the past year. She tried to repeat it, but she felt as if her hands were slipping on the polish, as if the sentence would not stave off terror any longer, because she was beginning to understand.
"If you don't know, the thing to do is not to get scared, but to learn."
It was in the bewildered loneliness of the first weeks of her marriage that she said it to herself for the first time. She could not understand Jim's behavior, or his sullen anger, which looked like weakness, or his evasive, incomprehensible answers to her questions, which sounded like cowardice. Such traits were not possible in the James Taggart whom she had married. She told herself that she could not condemn without understanding, that she knew nothing about his world, that the extent of her ignorance was the extent to which she misinterpreted his actions. She took the blame,
She took the beating of self-reproach, against some bleakly stubborn certainty which told her that something was wrong and that the thing she felt was fear.
I must learn everything that Mrs. James Taggart is expected to know and to be, was the way she explained her purpose to a teacher of etiquette. She set out to learn with the devotion, the discipline, the drive of a military cadet or a religious novice. It was the only way, she thought, of earning the height which her husband had granted her on trust, of living up to his vision of her, which it was now her duty to achieve. And, not wishing to confess it to herself, she felt also that at the end of the long task she would recapture her vision of him, that knowledge would bring back to her the man she had seen on the night of his railroad's triumph. She could not understand Jim's attitude when she told him about her lessons. He burst out laughing. She was unable to believe that the laughter had a sound of malicious contempt.
"Why, Jim? Why? What are you laughing at?"
He would not explain, almost as if the fact of his contempt were sufficient and required no reasons. She could not suspect him of malice. He was too patiently generous about her mistakes. He seemed eager to display her in the best drawing-rooms of the city, and he never uttered a word of reproach for her ignorance, for her awkwardness, for those terrible moments when a silent exchange of glances among the guests and a burst of blood to her cheekbones told her that she had said the wrong thing again. He showed no embarrassment. He merely watched her with a faint smile. When they came home after one of those evenings, his mood seemed affectionately cheerful. He was trying to make it easier for her, she thought, and gratitude drove her to study the harder. She expected her reward on the evening when, by some imperceptible transition, she found herself enjoying a party for the first time. She felt free to act, not by rules, but at her own pleasure, with sudden confidence that the rules had fused into a natural habit. She knew that she was attracting attention, but now, for the first time, it was not the attention of ridicule, but of admiration. She was sought after, on her own merit. She was Mrs. Taggart. She had ceased being an object of charity weighing Jim down, painfully tolerated for his sake. She was laughing gaily and seeing the smiles of response, of appreciation on the faces around her. And she kept glancing at him across the room, radiantly, like a child handing him a report card with a perfect score, begging him to be proud of her. Jim sat alone in a corner, watching her with an undecipherable glance. He would not speak to her on their way home. "I don't know why I keep dragging myself to those parties," he snapped suddenly, tearing off his dress tie in the middle of their living room. "I've never sat through such a vulgar, boring waste of time."
"Why, Jim," she said, stunned. "I thought it was wonderful."
"You would. You seem to be quite at home, quite as if it were Coney Island. I wish you'd learn to keep your place and not to embarrass me in public."
"I embarrassed you? Tonight?"
"You did."
"How?"
"If you don't understand it, I can't explain," he said in the tone of a mystic who implies that a lack of understanding is the confession of a shameful inferiority.
"I don't understand it," she said firmly.
He walked out of the room, slamming the door. She felt that the inexplicable was not a mere blank this time. It had a tinge of evil. From that night on, a small, hard point of fear remained within her, like the spot of a distant headlight advancing upon her down an invisible track. Knowledge did not seem to bring her a clearer vision of Jim's world, but to make the mystery greater. She could not believe that she was supposed to feel respect for the dreary senselessness of the art shows which his friends attended, of the novels they read, of the political magazines they discussed. The art shows, where she saw the kind of drawings she had seen chalked on any pavement of her childhood's slums. The novels that purported to prove the futility of science, industry, civilization, and love, using language that her father would not have used in his drunkenest moments.
the magazines that propounded cowardly generalities, less clear and more stale than the sermons for which she had condemned the preacher of the slum mission as a mealy-mouthed old fraud. She could not believe that these things were the culture she had so reverently looked up to and so eagerly waited to discover. She felt as if she had climbed a mountain toward a jagged shape that had looked like a castle, and had found it to be the crumbling ruin of a gutted warehouse.
"Jim," she said once, after an evening spent among the men who were called the intellectual leaders of the country, "Dr. Simon Pritchett is a phony. A mean, scared old phony."
"Now really," he answered, "do you think you're qualified to pass judgment on philosophers?"
"I'm qualified to pass judgment on con men. I've seen enough of them to know one when I see him."
"Now this is why I say that you'll never outgrow your background. If you had, you would have learned to appreciate Dr. Pritchett's philosophy."
"What philosophy?"
"If you don't understand it, I can't explain." She would not let him end the conversation on that favorite formula of his.
"Jim," she said, "he's a phony. He and Balfe Eubank and that whole gang of theirs, and I think you've been taken in by them."
Instead of the anger she expected, she saw a brief flash of amusement in the lift of his eyelids.
"That's what you think," he answered.
She felt an instant of terror at the first touch of a concept she had not known to be possible.
What if Jim was not taken in by them?
She could understand the phoniness of Dr. Pritchett, she thought. It was a racket that gave him an undeserved income. She could even admit the possibility by now that Jim might be a phony in his own business. What she could not hold inside her mind was the concept of Jim as a phony in a racket from which he gained nothing. An unpaid phony, an unvenal phony. The phoniness of a card sharp or a con man seemed innocently wholesome by comparison. She could not conceive of his motive. She felt only that the headlight moving upon her had grown larger. She could not remember by what steps, what accumulation of pain, first as small scratches of uneasiness, then as stabs of bewilderment, then as the chronic nagging pull of fear, she had begun to doubt Jim's position on the railroad. It was his sudden, angry, "So you don't trust me?" snapped in answer to her first innocent questions that made her realize that she did not. When the doubt had not yet formed in her mind, and she had fully expected that his answers would reassure her. She had learned in the slums of her childhood that honest people were never touchy about the matter of being trusted. "I don't care to talk shop," was his answer whenever she mentioned the railroad. She tried to plead with him once.
"Jim, you know what I think of your work and how much I admire you for it."
"Oh, really? What is it you married, a man or a railroad president?"
I never thought of separating the two."
"Well, it is not very flattering to me." She looked at him, baffled. She had thought it was.
"I'd like to believe," he said, "that you love me for myself and not for my railroad." "Oh, God, Jim," she gasped. "You didn't think that I..."
"No," he said, with a sadly generous smile. "I didn't think that you married me for my money or my position. I have never doubted you." Realizing in stunned confusion and in tortured fairness that she might have given him ground to misinterpret her feeling, that she had forgotten how many bitter disappointments he must have suffered at the hands of fortune-hunting women, she could do nothing but shake her head and moan, "Oh, Jim, that's not what I meant." He chuckled softly, as at a child, and slipped his arm around her.
"Do you love me?" he asked.
"Yes," she whispered.
"Then you must have faith in me.
Love is faith, you know. Don't you see that I need it? I don't trust anyone around me. I have nothing but enemies. I am very lonely. Don't you know that I need you?"
The thing that made her pace her room, hours later, in tortured restlessness, was that she wished desperately to believe him and did not believe a word of it, yet knew that it was true.
It was true, but not in the manner he implied, not in any manner or meaning she could ever hope to grasp. It was true that he needed her, but the nature of his need kept slipping past her every effort to define it. She did not know what he wanted of her. It was not flattery that he wanted. She had seen him listening to the obsequious compliments of liars, listening with a look of resentful inertness, almost the look of a drug addict at a dose inadequate to rouse him. But she had seen him look at her as if he were waiting for some reviving shot, and at times, as if he were begging. She had seen a flicker of life in his eyes whenever she granted him some sign of admiration.